Van Vula Okie Doke move and lays it up for two. Lee with a nifty move there.
He could go all the way, and the freshman takes it to the house with no time on the clock. Are you kidding me? He takes it 60 yards. Welcome to Redbird Nation.
And the shoe. She gives it to Katie Broadway. Broadway taking it herself down the left side. No good. But she's going to get on a rebound. Kicks it out. Kansas Sykes for three. No,
that's
good.
They got it.
Kansas Sykes for three.
From local high school action to the birds and the pros, with live interviews, reporting, debate, and discussion, WZND's Red Zone brings you all the sports you can handle each week. The Red Zone starts now, only on 103.3 WZND,
the pulse of Redbird Nation.
Please keep your arms inside the vehicle and enjoy the ride. This is the Red Zone on WZND. I'm Leo Stauderer, your sports director. I'm joined by my assistant sports director, Joey Dwyer, who will be taking a walk-on trial with the ISU men's basketball team. You can see his highlights on Huddle. And our producer, Joe Kennedy, who by day takes journalism classes and by night takes classes at the School of Hard Knocks. This is the Red Zone. For this week's show, we got a big one coming up. We got Illinois State baseball head coach Steve Holm on the show. We're going to have news and sports guest Brendan McInerney on. It's a jam show. So let's get right into it, guys. It was a busy week for ISU sports, and something that was kind of outside the norm. All three of us were able to take in a different sport in person this past week. I was at the ISU track meet on Friday. Joey was at the volleyball game on Saturday. And then Joe was able to attend a soccer match on Wednesday. Guys, let's just, get started. Let's talk about, one, the play we saw, and then, two, what it was like being in person. Joey, want to start by talking about volleyball?
Yeah, okay. So I'll go.
Must have been electric.
I'll go with volleyball. And, boys, after the Natty Championship got done on Monday, I have some sad news for everybody. I'm removing the word electric from my vocabulary.
Oh.
It's been overused. So I have to figure out a different word to describe the atmosphere at this volleyball game. So I'm going to say it was buzzing.
It was buzzing.
Because I went as a fan, which is the first time I've been to a Redbird sporting event as a fan in a minute. And it was so fun to be there. And this Redbirds volleyball team, man, they are dominant.
Mm-hmm.
They are, it was ridiculous how good they looked all game long. And even though, Kaylee Martin didn't have her best game, but Sydney Holt and Nicole Lund were there to step up and pick up the load. And this team is so deep. They're so good. They don't make practically any mistakes. I am very excited to watch them in the tournament coming up here in a couple weeks.
And UNLV, it's an interesting team, too, to scout and take a look at. They're in the Mountain West Conference. They've won 29 out of the last 30 games. But this year, they only played at 12 games overall, and they went 12-0 in those games. So they're coming in, and I think, finally, ISU has a chance to win this first-round game because they've always been having to go up against Wisconsin. It seems like they're always losing to
Wisconsin.
They've
faced Marquette the year before, too, right?
Yeah, Marquette.
They've had
to
face teams
some
that are
tough
in the top 10 in the nation
both
times. So this could be not an easier route, because any team that makes a tournament is going to be tough, but then having to face Kentucky in that game after could be a big challenge. But I think this team, they have, 2 years of tournament experience to build off, so I think they're more ready than they were the past 2 years. They're experienced. They're a seasoned team. That's got to be a tough matchup if you're UNLV.
No, yeah, I'm very excited to watch this team. This feels like kind of the culmination of Coach Johnson's first 4 years, really getting to recruit all of her own players and put this team together in her vision, and I think it's all coming to fruition now, and so this is all of her hard work paying off, and of course, all of the women out there on the court are really going all in here,
mm-hmm.
And I'm so excited. I'm bummed that we don't get to go cover it, because in a regular year we'd be sending people, and I'd be there in Omaha,
mm-hmm.
But it's still going to be fun to watch, even from home. Maybe we'll watch it here in the studio. I'll buy some pizza or something, and we'll watch the Birds win.
Yeah, we'll have something going on, definitely, but they just get better. Every single game goes on, and even in the tournament, it seems like every game they're getting better, and Sarah Kushner at the end, acing out the game or closing out the game. It was terrific to see, and ISU got it done at their home court in front of fans. I wasn't able to go to any games, but Joey and a lot of people on the staff were able to go to a lot of games, so it was a lot of fun to see that too.
But you were able to attend a soccer match last night, so tell
mm-hmm.
me a little bit about that, because we're
going
to be seeing more soccer here as the conference tournament will be here this week, or the first game of the conference tournament will be here this weekend.
Yeah, so the conference tournament, it was or yesterday's game, it was a good game. ISU was it was exciting. They had their chances to score the game or to win the game, but they just couldn't finish in the final third of the field. Like they hit the crossbar twice, and they had Sarah Lafayette had a breakaway. But after the game, the coach was talking about it and how they worked on this like throughout the week. On Tuesday, they like did a whole drill for this and how they haven't been able to finish kind of when they're down in games.
Yeah,
and when
I
they're down.
Say, I think that's been a recurring theme back when we talked to Marcel a couple weeks ago, that their late-game struggles have still been something they've been dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was still going on last night, you were saying.
Yeah.
And I got to say, and I'm you know, I'm a big Redbirds guy. I'm an even bigger Redbirds soccer guy. I was calling the game. So two big takeaways from this game. Number one, Nikki Coriel, who was the Valparaiso goaltender.
Oh my goodness,
wow. She was spectacular.
Yeah.
And like those breaks, like you talked about, Sarah Lafayette had the break. Allison Baker had another one. And another great save I remember was
off the corner, I think. Yeah.
There was a couple corner kicks. Michaela
Kirsten
had a bomb from like 40 yards out that was on its way upper 90. But Nikki Coriel was unreal for Valparaiso. And so she, like, hats off to her because she was unreal. And the second thing I got to say is I didn't quite understand the motivation behind Coach Sylvie in the last 15 minutes of the game when you're down one. Playoff seeding on the line, and he took out Ashley Santos and Riley O'Brien, two players who had a big impact in the game, and they both found their way to the bench for 10 of the last 15 minutes. And I understand that fatigue does play a role. And I saw, you could see like some of the players in the back, like Ashley Bakaitis, she was getting a little tired out there, but it just blew my mind that you would take away two of your best offensive threats in a game that you have to win in the last 15 minutes. You're only down one.
Yeah. You'd think if you're worried about their fatigue, take them out for 10 minutes, maybe at the start of the second half, not at the end when the game could be won or lost. So as they're seeded to face you and I in the first round of the MVC tournament, what do you guys think they need to improve on to try to get that win?
Well, their defense has been good. They've been able to shut down Valpo yesterday, and they really got a lucky goal. Valpo was off a free kick, and it was like a really bad angle, too. I think the keeper was just a little not in position for that one. And then they just got to keep doing what they've been talking about the entire season, is just trying to score in that final part of the field. Like, they have every chance. They set up the perfect play almost a lot of the times. They had 16 shots compared to 4 shots for Valpo yesterday in the second half. So they just got to be able to finish in that final third of the field. And if they're able to do that, they're dangerous. And Coach Sylvie was saying after the game that he thinks they're one of the most dangerous teams heading in the tournament.
And another thing that they do really well offensively is they have their back line sending through balls up to their forwards, and they always have clean breaks. That's how Sarah Lafayette got hers there in the second half, and that really comes off the back a lot of Alyssa Ramsden, and you saw Ariana Lombardi, who plays right back, she was doing it a lot as well, getting the ball through the midfield in the air, and then that kind of springs your forwards, and that's something that they get a lot of chances when they do it, but they just need to do it a little more efficiently because they have the speed. Their forwards have the speed. They just need to be able to convert on those chances, like you were saying.
Yeah, they're a dangerous team, but there's also another dangerous team we have going on here at ISU, Leo.
Yeah, so as I mentioned, Jose Sandoval and I took in the Redbird invite last Friday on the track and field side, and on a 40-degree day, I wouldn't have thought it would be possible for me to get sunburned, but I did just by spending the whole day out there.
Yeah, you can't sleep on the sun, even when it's cold.
I think the thing most impressive for me was that this was the Redbirds asserting how good they are again, because there were some good teams there. There was Marquette, Butler, Northern Illinois, Loyola Chicago, but what struck me most was how balanced the Redbirds were, because Loyola and Marquette mostly had distance runners. Northern had a very good field team, and then Butler also was solid in the field and the throws, but the Redbirds were solid in basically all three facets of track and field, where they had the field athletes and the throwers and the jumps, they had sprinters, and they had distance runners. So we saw Grace Beatty set a facility record in the 5,000 meter. Maya Robinson and Brandon Ratliff set top 5 times in ISU history in the hurdles. And then the field was killing it. Recurring guest Kamisha Smith just had another solid day.
Of course she did.
So it was, I think, seeing them match up against some other Division I programs, some good, in some cases, Power 5 teams, they still were just looked just as good as they've always looked this season.
And they're going to Ole Miss, I believe.
Yeah, the Joe Walker invited Ole Miss.
So that's a huge one.
That'll
SEC?
Be a tough challenge because, yeah, in track and field, the Pac-12 and the SEC are dominant because they can train outside all year. So it'll be interesting to see how a Midwest team like the Redbirds that's very balanced fares.
And one may argue that training in Horton Fieldhouse is almost like training.
I
was just playing some intramural volleyball there on Tuesday. So I can tell you that the ground there is a very interesting mix of like gym floor and like the foam pits you would jump into as a kid.
It's like soft.
It's really weird.
It's like a very humid swamp like atmosphere.
It very much is. But you know what? The Birds can train in there. They train outside and they're always dominant. So more power to them.
Yeah, and that'll be a big challenge now, seeing how they train against a team that gets to compete in 70 degree weather all year, because that's always a problem at Nationals. Is when you get these Midwestern athletes that are training in the cold all year, have to run in May in the Midwest, and then have to go run in California for Nationals where it's 90 degrees, and they may not have trained in a day like that. That's always a challenge. So it's good that they're getting a rep like that at this point in the season. And as I mentioned, we're going to have Steve Holm on the show later. But before we get to that interview, April 7th yesterday marked a somber anniversary to Redbird Nation. On that day in 2015, 7 Redbirds were returning home from the Final Four in Indianapolis when their plane crashed. While 6 years have passed, their impact will never be forgotten. There is a memorial outside Redbird Arena where you can pay homage to them. On this day and every day, we remember the lives of the Redbird 7.
The 7. Scott Bittner, Andy Butler, Tom Heilman, Jason Jones, Aaron Leach, Terry Strelo, and Torrey Ward. Scott Bittner graduated from Illinois State, where he was a member of the Sigma Chi fraternity. He owned Eureka Locker Incorporated in Eureka. Scott's generosity to the community was well known as he worked with local farmers and consumers. He was an avid golfer and dedicated sports fan. His family was his passion, and he was a devoted husband and father. Scott left behind a wife, Carrie, a daughter, Ella, and a son, Hayden. He was 42. Andy Butler graduated from Illinois State with a degree in marketing in 1996. He had a successful career as a sales manager for Sprint Nextel and was promoted to national account manager, serving large clients like State Farm, Country Financial, and ADM. He was very active in the Bloomington Normal business community. He is survived by fiancée Jamie Fox and parents Donald and Sheila Butler. He was 40. Tom Heilman proudly served his country in the U.S. Air Force and National Guard. After the service, he graduated from Southern Illinois with degrees in aviation and aviation management. He was a self-employed pilot and owner of Heilman Aviation in Bloomington. He loved sports and enjoyed coaching youth football. He left behind his wife, Amy, and 5 children, Ben, Adam, Andrea, Luke, and Jake. He was 51. Jason Jones graduated from Illinois Wesleyan in 1991, where he lettered in baseball and basketball, then received his master's degree from Illinois State University. Jason was the senior vice president and certified financial planner at Wells Fargo Advisors. He was a loving father, devoted husband, caring son, and brother. He left behind a wife, Lindsay, and 2 children, Jack and Kate. He was 45. Aaron Leach graduated from Tennessee Temple in 1999 and went on to receive his MBA from Baylor in 2001. It was there that he jumped into college athletics and continued on with a fast-paced and successful career. He first worked at Illinois State from 2005 to 2011, before returning in June of 2013 to serve as the Deputy Director of Athletics. He left behind his wife, Lindsay, and 2 daughters, Avery and Emerson. He was 37. Terry Strelo received his bachelor's degree in business administration from Illinois State University in 1974. He co-owned and operated Pub 2, which has grown immensely over the years. Through the pub, Terry influenced so many lives, from college kids to the entire Bloomington Normal community. He left behind his wife Joan and 2 children, Jill and Jordan. He was 64. Torrey Ward played college basketball at UAB, where he competed in 110 games with 74 starts and scored almost 800 points during his career. In 2001, Torrey earned a criminal justice degree from UAB. Torrey coached for 3 seasons at ISU, spending his first 2 as an assistant and his final season as the associate head coach. He left behind 3 children, Tamia, Torrey, and Audrey, fiance Janine Beasel, and mother, Janice Ward. He was 36.
Welcome back to the Red Zone. Leo Sauterher, Joey Dwyer, and Joe Kennedy. We're now joined by Illinois State Baseball head coach Steve Holm. Coach Holm is in his third year as the coach of the Redbirds. And, you know, as I mentioned, it's your third year, and you've had pretty much a ride like that there you can't script with the COVID year and everything else going on. How have you been able to build your culture while also guiding your players through a global pandemic?
I don't think anybody's been, you know, great at guiding their players through a pandemic, because there was no, you know, template for that for anybody. But ultimately, I mean, we tried to check in with those guys. We were doing it once a week when we first shut down last year. We had like a Zoom party like this type of deal on certain days. And then I was trying to update them, because we were getting a lot of updates through the athletic department once a week. And so there was tidbits coming out that were obviously somewhat, you know, informative to them about what next year might look like. And obviously all that stuff was changing every week. So we were just trying to keep them in the loop, as opposed to just sending them home and, you know, we'll see you in August type of thing. And then as the summer wore on, you know, we started doing it less and less, because there was no information to give at a certain point. But ultimately it's that part has been hard, because our culture that when we got here, you know, we had all the players over to my house in the fall. We'd bring individual players over, like in January, like the hitting coach would take four or five guys to his house. I would bring a couple pitchers to my house, and we did that as it would go on. But obviously those were not things that protocol was going to allow for this year. So that particular piece has been very elusive, I think, for not just us, but every coach in the country, because you're just not allowed to do it. So you're trying to find ways to get the team together, but you try and find ways to keep them healthy and all that. And those two things don't necessarily go together.
So have there been any ways that you figured out emulate that team bonding experience when you can't all be together in person?
We do a better job of it when you're on the road, because you have to be on the bus, right? I mean, there's no way to really socially distance on the bus. And so you can have a little bit of that, you know, atmosphere there. You get in the dugout, obviously. Dugouts are, you know, only so big. So it has to happen more in those environments where you can't kind of – where you can say you can't really get away from it. You cannot have a organized, you know, situation where you put them into as close as you would be on a bus. So I think it's just – trying to get creative with some things like that, where, you know, you can be on the bus together, you can have, you know, some meals where they're eating in the dugout or stuff like that. But they're really the other piece to it, where outside of the, you know, actual team travel or something like that, that piece has just not really happened.
And so I mentioned you're in your third year as a head coach, but obviously you had a long career playing baseball professionally. Who were some coaches you had, whether it was in college or the pros, that you tried to emulate in your style as a coach?
One of the best coaches I had, it was a manager I had in A-ball. His name was Lenny Sakata. He backed up Cal Ripken Jr. So you obviously don't get to play a whole lot when you're backing up Cal Ripken Jr. And he grabbed me, you know, when I think it was my second year with him. He said, look, if you're ever going to play in the big leagues, you're going to be a backup. You know, like we got to kind of teach you how to hit like a backup, you know. And he goes, I was a backup. You know, I obviously know how to do that. So that piece, you know, as a player, you know, a little humbling, right? You're like, well, you know, I kind of wanted to be a starter, but, you know, this guy's telling you the real thing. But he treated every guy on the roster, because I was never a top prospect or anything like that. And, you know, we obviously had $1 million signing bonus guys on the team, but he treated every guy the same, whether you were a $1 million prospect or you were a guy like myself who was the extra catcher. So that's a piece that I really, you know, took from him. And the other thing that he did a great job of, because pro ball, there's not a great, what you guys, you know, always refer to as culture. And they talk about culture a lot in college sports, but professional baseball is a little bit more, you know, dog eat dog, you know, business, you know, out for yourself type of deal. And he was somehow able to create a little bit of culture before I probably understood what he was actually doing, you know. But when I look back at it now, I'm like, oh, yeah, it was pretty smart. But he would always eat lunch with all the players. You know, like guys would – in San Jose, there was a little – like a lobby, I guess, that you'd come into the clubhouse, and guys would grab their food on the way to the field, and they'd come there and eat their lunch. And he would sit there for like an hour and a half and he'd be done with his lunch, but he'd still sit there as other guys were coming in to eat. And he got to know them. He got to know their girlfriend's name, their, you know, what was going on with them off the field. And then when guys started to struggle, he understood why, you know, because maybe, you know, this was going on off the field with this guy. I mean, you know, professional baseball, you got guys that are married, you got guys going through divorces, kids, you know, there's a lot more going on than just what, you know, the average college guy where, you know, he may maybe just failed a test or something. But I think that's the piece from him that was so impressive as a player is, you know, he got to know everybody, but he also cared about them.
So do you take that kind of like a player's first mentality into your coaching philosophy?
Yeah, I mean, and those are the pieces that are so hard to not do this year is, you know, like that simple as eating lunch with players. Like when I was at Sac State, that was my first coaching job when I got done playing. The student union was kind of like right behind the right field wall. So you could walk over and at lunchtime grab your lunch and you'd find players. Oh, they'd be sitting in there and you just could grab your Panda Express or whatever you were grabbing and go sit down and eat with them. And that's the piece that, you know, at this point, you know, this year you're not able to do. And that's the hard part because that's one thing that we try to do as a staff is whether it be with recruits or not, we always try to go eat with them. Because when you eat with people, they kind of get relaxed because it's something that we all do, right? We're all comfortable eating and you get a little bit different side of the player. You know, because they're able to open up. When they come on the field, they put on a front for me as a coach that they don't put on if you're at Chipotle, you know. So that piece has obviously been taken away from you, so that's the harder part. But ultimately, yeah, that is, you know, that's a piece that I think is very important, you know, because you can – they'll talk about off-the-field stuff there. When we're at the field, they're not going to talk about, you know – what they're struggling with in their math class or something when you're trying to, you know, work with them as a hitter or something like that. So that is the piece that we try to hone in on, I guess.
And why did you want to become a head coach? And how did that opportunity arrive to you? You first started off in Sacramento State. Was it a friend or how did you get that job?
So when I was I'm originally from Sacramento, and when I was playing, I'd gone out to Sac State a couple times and hit, you know, before spring training or something. And the coach had heard me talking to some of the other, you know, pro guys that were, you know, out there at their field. And it had intrigued him enough that when he had a coaching change happen, this was my last year as a player. He reached out to a mutual friend and said, "Hey, do you think this guy would be interested? You know, I have an opening and I'd love to talk to him about it." So we ended up getting connected on the phone and I talked to him one night. And I told him, I said, "Look, you know, I'm in AAA with the Marlins, you know, foul tip away. And, you know, as a catcher, you can go back up to the big leagues, you know. So, you know, I'm interested, but, you know, I got to see how the season plays out. But I am 32 years old and, you know, I'm got a flat tire on one of my legs. And, you know, some of those things are, you know, I am being realistic here." And he goes, "Okay, well, you know, I'll circle back before I ever hire anybody." So ultimately, he 3 days later, I got released by the Marlins. And it was the middle of the year, and at that point, I know I'm not going to get a job. I hadn't played enough and had done well enough when I did play. And so I called him back, and I was like, you know, I might be a little bit more interested in that job than I was, you know, 3 days ago. So I went and met with him and sat down and talked, and I wanted to give it a one-year shot and see how I liked it. Because I had plenty of opportunity to go back into professional baseball and be a manager and, you know, try to climb that ladder back through the minor leagues again. And, you know, at the end of that first year, I really enjoyed the level of the player, you know, that age that you can kind of really help them, you know, more than you can a professional player. Well, you know, like by the time you get to AA, AAA, you know yourself as a player, and the coaches are just there to kind of corral the team, I guess. And they're not really, you know, changing or impacting it too much. But ultimately, at the college level, I mean, guys are coming to college and, you know, They're like a sponge, so soak up anything. So I really enjoyed that piece, and I played for 12 years, and I never gotten a chance to sleep in my own bed. And I bought a house a couple of years, you know, I think it was after my second year in the big leagues. And so I bought a house, and I'd never slept at my house. You know, I'd only been there in the off seasons and stuff. So that was really nice to be able to sleep in your own bed per se, and and not be living out of a suitcase for 6-7 months out of the year. And so that's why I chose the college baseball, you know, thing. And then my wife is from St. Louis. So our ultimate goal was to get back to the Midwest, where by the time we had kids, we were close enough to her parents or something like that, that she could drive to see them and vice versa. And that's how I ended up at Purdue. And then obviously, you know, from Purdue, you advanced to here, which it's obviously even closer to St. Louis.
And so still being pretty early in your coaching career here at ISU, what were some of the things that when you came on were maybe not challenges, but unexpected when you first got here?
You know, we had a lot of talent on our team when we first got here in 2019. And people had told me before I took the job and as I was taking it, because obviously you take it in the summer and you can't see your players till, you know, August or whatever. You know, they're like, hey, you got some good players, you know. So when the fall started, we were pleasantly surprised with, you know, some of the players. It wasn't exactly built the way that we wanted the team built, you know, ideally. There was some holes and some things like that. But, you know, we coached it the best way we thought we could with, you know, the way that the team was built itself, and kind of had to get a little out of our own, you know, ideal, you know, way of doing things. And, you know, like that team had a lot of offense and not a lot of bullpen. You know, ultimately, I would like to get this thing to where you felt like you had a ton of bullpen, you know, that you can run at guys. And, you know, we're still not to that situation yet. But, you know, so I think that at the talent level that was here. And then the other thing that we noticed right away was, you know, Wally and I came on in July or whatever. I think it was early July. And we'd be out recruiting in the summertime, and there were so many people within that, you know, the Chicago baseball scene, which obviously is a big recruiting ground for us, that played at ISU or had ISU connections. And, you know, I knew that I wanted to look into this job when it came open, because I'd recruited in Chicago when I was at Purdue. And you drive around Chicago and you see that little license plate cover that says University of Illinois or Illinois State. And when you drive through Chicago, those are the two that you see. You don't really see all the other schools. You see Illinois State and Illinois. And so I knew it was a school you can win at, because I feel like if you can buy the hat at the mall, you can recruit to the school, you know, no matter where it is. And so that was the other piece, is how much pride there was with the Illinois State people. They were coming, oh, you're the new ISU coach. My wife went there, you know, or, you know, my dad went there. I went there. I played football there. And there was so many connections to ISU that it was easy to recruit to from day one, even though we didn't have any track record. You know, it was a head coach whose record was 0-0. And, you know, obviously the team before us wasn't great, because otherwise it wouldn't have been making a change. But guys still wanted to come here because of the school. And that was the good part, because you never want to, you know, have to talk people into wanting to come to your place. You want them to kind of answer the phone when you call a recruit, you know, with some, you know, anticipation, as opposed to dreading the call, you know. So those two things, I think, were the biggest surprises and, you know, welcome surprises.
So to wrap up, because we're running out of time, but yeah. when we were researching for this interview, we found something about some story about your only major league home run on Mother's Day. And the story said that your mom was up doing something and was at the game but couldn't see it, and we needed to know if that was true.
No, so it was on Mother's Day, and it was in San Francisco. And I'm from Sacramento, which is only about 90 miles away. So my mom was there. She was sitting there. It was my grandparents. They were in town because my grandparents used to have a place in Arizona, and then they live in Idaho. So they would go to Arizona in the winter, and then they would kind of cruise back to Idaho, you know, when the weather got better. So they were on their way back up, and they were at the game. Well, my grandpa, I was not playing that game. So I pinch hit and hit the home run. It was a game-winning, you know, home run. And, but my grandpa had gotten up and went and got ice cream with my grandma. So they were standing in line getting ice cream. They hear the whole stadium, you know, there's, you know, 30,000 people there screaming, and they're going, oh, okay, you know, something must have good happened. They had no idea. They come back, they're eating ice cream, they sit down, and everyone around them, I had a bunch of, you know, family there that day. And they're sitting there like, did you see it? And they're like, see what? You know, so they were the ones that were not registering what was going on. But my mom was sitting there and she did get to see it.
Okay, okay. As long as your mom got to see it on Mother's Day, no, I think that's the important thing.
So, and I got the ball back. There was a fan that had caught it, obviously, and I had to trade him a signed helmet and a bat, and he gave me the ball back.
That's a good trade. That's a good trade.
Easy trade. I mean, you go back in the equipment room and you steal a helmet that didn't belong to you and give it to him, right? I mean,
Matters blow the helmet.
We'd like to thank Coach Steve Holm for joining us for that interview. And Joey, you have something for us.
Well, boys, after a grueling quarantine winter, a lot of people are still recovering from the winter blues. And to kick off summer right, WZND Staycation Giveaway is giving listeners the chance to win prizes every weekday for the next 3 weeks. Call in to WZND for your chance to enter into a drawing for a JBL speaker this Friday. To participate, all you have to do is call us at 309-438-1033. That is 309-438-1033. Call in now to WZND Staycation Giveaway for an opportunity to win some exclusive prizes. Just keep in mind, if you call right now and we pick up, you win not only a chance to win a JBL speaker this Friday, how cool is that? You're also going to win some merch. Who doesn't want some merch? Joe. I see Joe over there. He's walking the board. He wants some merch. B-Mac, our news and sports guest, he's right there. He wants some merch. And you know Leo wants some merch. So call in 309-438-1033. Call now to win.
Red Zone, Leo Stocker, Joey Dwyer, and Joe Kennedy. As you can tell by the music, we're probably going to talk about some Chicago Blackhawks, but first, let's welcome our guest for the first time on Red Zone, Brendan McInerney. Brendan, tell us a little about what you want to bring tonight.
Well, first off, thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course. Let's go, B-Max up in the studio.
Yep. Tonight we're going to talk about the Blackhawks, and I think the Blackhawks are in a pretty interesting situation right now. Obviously, they're a young team with some veteran presence mixed in among the youngsters. Clearly, they exceeded expectations early on in the season and then kind of came down back to earth in March. I think they went 5-9. So, you know, they kind of hit that wall. But, you know, you put it all together and now you've got a middle-of-the-pack team. They're currently sitting in fifth in the Central Division, 2 points beyond the Nashville for fourth place. And, you know, you look forward to the trade deadline. I think it's coming up Monday now. It's like, do the Hawks buy or sell? Because everyone in Chicago loves playoff hockey.
Everyone just sat up.
Okay, I want to preface this conversation we're about to have with about the Blackhawks with a little context. Leo Stodher, our very own, and Brendan McInerney are roommates. They live together. Three of us in the room, Joe Kennedy, B-Mac, myself, are huge Blackhawks fans. And ironically, the person wearing the Marian Hossa jersey, Leo Stodher, is a Blackhawks hater. He hates everything about the Blackhawks. He hates every move they make. So I just want to give a little context to the listeners before we jump into this. And so, B-Mac, your question was, are the Hawks buyers or sellers? And I think the hater should go first.
Well, let's talk about that there, because I think they're in a position where it's not a rebuild because they didn't really bottom out or have much prospects that aren't here that aren't already on the roster. So it's a retooling year, I'd say. So I think this year they probably shouldn't, they should not buy. And they should maybe try to sell off some assets on their team that might have value to some other teams in similar situations, like a Matthias Janmark or a Carl Soderberg, but don't give away anything that's part of your future for anything short term. I've actually kind of liked the past couple moves, contrary to what Joey might think.
Today's
Hinostroza move, where you traded a ECHLer for a player that, you know, is maybe just a solid third liner, and even today's move, where you took on a contract Florida was trying to get rid of and got a prospect with high-end potential, possibly, in Henrik Borgstrom in exchange for that, for taking on that contract they were trying to get rid of. So more moves like that, where you're maybe not going for a home run trade, but getting some players that might have more value that could fit in maybe in the long-term picture for this team, I think that's the direction they need to take. They should not be trying to sell off any of these young players for somebody that will only be around for half a year or for a year, because I still think they got a long way to go before they're contenders again, but they are building towards being better in the future.
And so do you think today's move, do you think this is the last move the Hawks are going to make before the trade deadline? Or
I hope not.
I also think, with the players they have, it would be just crazy that they would trade away any of the young players. But I feel like it's going to be hard to trade away, like, Janmark and the older guys a little bit more. Because
I think Janmark might have some value because he's having a career year.
Like a little,
he's always need depth forwards. I think you could sell, you know, a stupid GM on a player having a career year and get something for
like
him.
Like a small thing, like a
mid-round pick or like a B-tier prospect. I think that could be huge. And I think also you got to think about there's the potential of an expansion draft, so they want to keep some of these veterans on the roster because you have to leave some players unprotected.
Yeah.
So if you got a player like Brett Connolly, who they just got from the Panthers, on the roster, that's less likely they're going to have to leave one of their younger players unprotected.
Mm-hmm. And I think that there are some guys and some teams that would really be interested in picking up some of these guys, like you said, Carl Soderberg in particular, because when the Hawks acquired Carl Soderberg, I was not happy about the move. Yeah. I thought he was old, slow, and worthless. But he's been a legitimately good power play player for the Hawks. I think he's had at least a little bit of value, and I think that's something that you could, like Leo said, you could sell on to a team that needs a little bit of veteran presence on a very young team, like the Rangers, really lack that kind of, like, veteran presence.
I mean, maybe this is where you think I'm the hater, where I think the Soderberg thing, I have no use for him on this team because I think you need to have a young player taking those minutes. If this is really a rebuild or a retool, you need...
I agree.
Why, like, there's been so many games where they've had the empty net.
Like, why do you need to play him?
Like,
he's 35 years old.
Yeah, get rid of him and give his minutes to young guys. So I think that's exactly what they need to do. Sell off the guys that aren't part of the future and just let the youth on your own roster fill those roles.
This guy.
What?
This guy. Leo's a hater. Leo's a hater just because he's not a meathead Hawks fan, in my mind. You're not a meathead, and so when you say things that have rational thought behind them, they hurt my meathead ears, Leo.
I'm sorry.
Okay, but getting off of the trade deadline for a second, what do you guys think about the season as it's progressed right now? Because I know that we were talking about it early in the season. This team shocked all of us with how well they were playing without Jonathan Toews and without Kirby Dach.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think they bring in a bunch of guys who, you know, weren't getting playing time in a bunch of other teams. And, you know, these guys came in like this is their last chance to make a statement. And they really came out kind of with an edge. And, you know, a lot of these guys have kind of evolved with the Hawks here early on the season. And, you know, it's kind of like they're almost like their last chance here. So they've definitely shown up.
And Brandon Hagel, I feel like, is an interesting story, too, especially made his debut like the day before the pandemic shut everything down
right.
and didn't really see much of him in the playoffs.
And that's what I've been clamoring for years, is just instead of getting, you know, your Jordan Tutus or your Tommy Wingles or all these bums they have to fill out their bottom
well,
six,
yeah, I agree
letting
with
their
you
own
that.
Prospects
yeah.
play and learn these roles. And that's huge. We've seen Brandon Hagel, as Joe mentioned, Philip Kurashev, Pius Suter, all these younger guys are filling in through that organizational depth, and they're doing that on the defense, too, where they've shed Olimata and Slater Cuckoo, and I've had players like Ian Mitchell, Nicholas Baudin, Wyatt Kalmuck just recently make his debut. That's what they need to be doing, is getting more players up, some younger players that they're going to have around in the future playing in meaningful minutes.
So you mentioned Ian Mitchell, and this is one thing, and this is why I hate that we don't get to talk about the Hawks every week, because there's so many things that I want to talk to you guys about.
So much this season.
But
this Hawks sent Ian Mitchell down to Rockford, what in God's name was that?
Well, that was weird because he was down and he was right back up. And so...
Was Jeremy Colleton trying to teach him a lesson for something? Or, like, what the hell was that? Because he did that, and that's one of your best young defensemen. Like, him and Adam Boqvist are the future of this D for the Hawks.
Part of it comes from developing defensemen. And I'm not defending the move to send him down because I think he should be out playing. But I think part of it is developing defensemen is so hard. And it's you think about Mitchell. He's only ever played in a college hockey season, so he's playing more games than he's ever played this year. So I think what they were trying to do, I don't agree with it, was give him a rest. Let him go back, play against players more at his level so he could dominate or whatever, but I don't care. I don't want him dominating a bunch of bums in the minor leagues. He needs to be up playing.
That's why my dad, when I was playing baseball, he always made me play up, right? When I was 10 years old, I never got to play U10. I was always playing U12 against kids who were bigger than me because my dad was trying to build character. But Jeremy Carlton doesn't know anything about building character. He thinks that this is just a soft world that these players live in. And
well, he is the great communicator, as they'll always tell you.
Oh my goodness. I'm on Leo's side now. I'm a Blackhawks hater.
I mean,
I just thought about Jeremy Colleton for 5 seconds and now I'm frustrated.
Yeah, so let's talk a little bit about Jeremy Colleton and how he runs this. All right, Leo, hang in before you. How he runs this team.
Leo just sat up in his chair. He's
Leo's
rubbing.
Been waiting for the segment all year.
He has, actually. We've been talking about this literally every week, but he came over and he took over for Joel Quenneville, who's now leading the Florida Panthers, who are first in the division now. And we're seeing that he kind of took a Panthers team that was good at the moment, but they've even elevated their game now with Quenneville as their head coach. So, and now the Hawks are to Colleton. So how do you feel Colleton's been doing this year with the team he's assembled with Bowman?
I mean, the results haven't matched the process at all. They've been winning games where they get drastically outshot, and the few games they play well in, they end up losing. So this team's so unpredictable, and it comes because of systemic problems. Their defensive system is pretty much a joke, where the man-to-man system, it basically takes one good pass to beat it. There are so many goals that get scored where you have the defenseman up at the blue line. And then so it comes down to they're expending so much energy chasing teams around the defensive zone because teams beat it by just cycling, moving their defensemen and wingers around and changing spots. So the Hawks are just chasing the whole time in the defensive zone as opposed to the zone where they're planted and more moving. So then when they do have to break it out, they don't have much energy then to get those quick transitions that we saw a lot of in the Quenneville era and get it up and down ice and score quick. So they have to dump and change and then can't establish offensive possession. But Joey, your hand's raised. Go ahead.
Leo. Leo was telling us probably an hour before the show. He's like, guys, I got this stat for you, and it's going to blow your minds. And we're like, Leo, just say it. He's like, no, we're saving it for the show. So, Leo,
I was bringing up why I don't like about Jeremy Colleton, but this is where it's getting to it. So in games that matter, this Colleton's teams always just dramatically underperform, do not rise to the occasion. In the second half of the season, in his 3 seasons there, in games against a direct competitor, meaning ahead of them in the standings or behind them in the standings, directly in front of or behind, they are 3-13-3 against direct competitors in the most important games of the season. So I have no trust in him for developing young players in meaningful games with potential playoff implications. I think, if anything, he might stunt their development more by teaching them a bad system and not teaching them to win in meaningful games either.
That's a good stat, Leo.
Yeah,
okay, so
thank you.
So after this year, nothing's probably going to happen with the coaching staff.
I think he's bought himself another year because they've exceeded expectations this year.
So when do you think the front office takes a look, and when do you think it would be enough is enough that Colleton would have to be fired for all you guys? What do you think?
Brennan, you want to try this one?
What would it take to get Jeremy Colleton fired, I guess?
Well, you know, I feel like when they first hired him as coach, you know, with his stint in the AHL and everything, he was kind of put out to be like a prodigy. So, you know, I think he kind of bought himself enough time for when he was initially hired. You know, I would think it takes some pretty drastic couple losing seasons consecutively to do that, and you know, with the young guys in place now, I just don't really see that happening.
But here's my issue with it. It's not just Colleton anymore. I think Bowman's got to go. I thought Bowman had to go when they got rid of Q.
Yeah, I think
other than the overseas scouting in Europe, which has been fantastic, finding Dominic Kubalik, Pius Suter, guys like that, they really have not done very much in terms of the draft, in terms of developing players. They pick players. They got the lottery draft, and then they pick players from the Swedish Elite League who are already great, and they're like, here, just come be great for my team. Instead, there's no development going on, and that's just not a sustainable way to build a franchise.
Well, I look at it now, I think Bowman's bought himself time. He's fine because I think, not fine, but I think he's unfireable in the eyes of Rocky Wirtz. I think it's more Colleton, whose seat might be a little hotter after this year because now they've exceeded expectations this year. They're probably going to finish just short of a playoff spot if we're being realistic. And then so the young players have shown, some of them have shown steps next year. So I think if they get off to another bad start, which they probably will when they have to go back to division against the Wild and the Avalanche and the Blues, teams that are doing better. I think if they get off to a slow start next year, that seat might start to heat up. And if they can't, you know, build off the momentum they've established this year, that's when I think we might see a coaching change. And who knows when we'll see a GM change? Yeah. Probably never.
Yeah, it'll be Stan Bowman until he dies, yeah. And then his son will take over.
And it's just crazy to look at with Jonathan Toews, who knows about him, Andrew Shaw, who knows about him, and then Seabrook's gone. But one person who's stayed here forever, leading the team in minutes on ice, is Duncan Keith. And he's not the player he was a couple of years ago, but he's still a top defenseman, and he's still getting the job done. He's still pretty athletic on the ice, and you got to give him credit for that, because him and Kane, they've stuck around, and they're still some of the top players on the team.
Okay, so that brings up to what what this team needs. In order to be good, they've needed Vezina caliber goaltending from Kevin Lankinen. They've needed two of the best players of their generation to be performing at MVP levels over 30 years old, and they've needed a top five power play in the league. So that goes back to the coaching has failed them at a fundamental level, and that you're asking so much of these guys that it's just it's unsustainable.
And it really is. Like you mentioned, you've got all of these players. You've got Patrick Kane having a career year, which is saying a lot because he is one of the best players in our lifetime. You've
best
got
American
Duncan,
ever.
You've got Duncan Keith playing at a great level. And then you have all of these guys who are playing at an unsustainable level. Guys like Philip Kurashev, Pius Suter, these guys who you don't know exactly what they are, to steal a phrase Leo likes to use all the time. These are guys who you don't really know, but they're just exceeding expectations. And as soon as the ceiling crashes on those guys, you can't rely on Patrick Kane and Alex DeBrincat to get you all of
those
points.
Two guys,
It really is. And so the future of the Hawks, hopefully they figure it out here. But, you know, maybe they sneak into the playoffs, and then we all get to watch some playoff hockey and go up.
Watch them lose.
We all get to go up to the south side and hang out with Leo and B-Mac and get some drinks and watch the Hawks.
It'll be a fun night.
Exactly.
That will be fun. And that will be so much fun that we're going to keep running around for another segment. When we come back, we're going to be talking some MLB baseball. So stick around for that. You're listening to Red Zone on 103.3 WZND, the pulse of Redbird Nation.
Hi, this is Paul DeYoung, former ISU Redbird, current St. Louis Cardinal. You're listening to Red Zone on WZND.
Welcome back to the Red Zone. Leo Sauter, Joey Dwyer, Joe Kenny. We're still joined by Brennan McInerney because not only is he a hockey expert, he's a Hall
he's
of Fame
baseball
person, brother. And he's a huge Chicago White Sox fan. Brennan, so first, get some thoughts off your chest about this White Sox start, because I know you have them.
I know what you're going to talk about right away, too.
Right. Well, there's mixed feelings about it. Obviously, we knew this team coming in, this lineup could absolutely rake. That was without a question. We knew that. Defensively, though, you know, it looks like they've just forgot the fundamentals of baseball. It's really that simple. And not even that, just mental mistakes on the base paths and stuff like that. You know, you like to think that this is stuff that will kind of smooth out over time, but, I mean, I'm kind of... And it's not just, like, from your young second baseman, Nick Madrigal. He's the one that's probably made the most errors so far.
Oh, my God.
And also mental mistakes by, like, Adam Eaton in right field. Like, this is a guy who, you know, just won a World Series with the Nationals a couple of years ago as a starter, and he's always been above average, you know, in the outfield. It's just... It's blowing my mind.
When I saw that play opening day, that ball that went off of Giolito's glove in the infield and it bounced just like dribbled towards Nick Madrigal and he looked like he'd never seen a baseball before in his life. I was like, okay, we might be in for a little bit of a rough season. But I mean, other than the gloves, this team has been so fun to watch. Yermin Mercedes has been such a great story for the White Sox this year. I just love this team, and it's so nice that they're finally good, because we had to put up through so many bad teams. And so it's just awesome, and I'm just reveling in the moment of having one of the most talented teams in the MLB.
So with Yermin Mercedes, do you guys think he can keep this up, or do you think not keep this up, obviously, but do you think he can, like, still have a really, above, like, maybe a .280 batting average going into the end of the year or halfway through the year?
I think the way this roster is constructed, they need him to, because, I mean, we saw they were starting a guy named Nick Williams in the outfield today, and who even is that?
I'm pretty sure Nick Williams played nose tackle for the Chicago Bears six seasons ago.
Yeah.
I think somebody can fact check me on that. Yeah, but just bouncing around all the Chicago sports like Jordan.
That's how bad their depth is this season, that you're an injury to Adam Eaton and Billy Hamilton away from having Nick Williams starting in your outfield. So they need Yermin to produce at a Hall of Fame pace.
The fact that you're a Billy Hamilton injury away from something worse.
Yeah,
it's brutal, and it all this all stems from Eloy getting hurt.
Well,
and
it
then,
doesn't. It's not Eloy. Like, it's because the fact that they didn't add any depth.
Exactly,
in the
offseason. And that the Eloy injury is showing that now because the Sox are coming in. Rickon, Tony La Russa are just like, okay, well, we've got two really good outfielders and then one that's kind of okay in Adam Eaton. And so it's like, okay, we can just ride with this. We have
Hope
Adam Engel.
Everybody stays healthy for 162 games.
Especially
imagine
after a
that
year
going
that
going
really
on.
You don't know what's going to happen. I mean, yeah. Last year was just a crazy year. Like, it wasn't a full season. It was literally, what, 37% of a normal year last year?
Yeah.
And so no one really got a good look at anything, and, like, injuries weren't able to
were
pile up.
That, like, no stats last season matter because it was so weird. So, like... Brennan, I
MVP awards last season do matter.
That matters.
They do matter. Jose Abreu
Jose,
is a...
But Brennan, I got to ask, what have been your early thoughts on Tony La Russa returning to manage the White Sox? How have you thought his in-game decisions have been lately?
You know, it's definitely spiked some controversy. Like, even today, you mentioned Nick Williams. He started over Andrew Vaughn in the outfield, and here's Andrew Vaughn, your rookie who everyone's glorified for the past, since they drafted him. And, you know, it makes you wonder... You know, they're just wasting his service time if he's only playing, 50% of the games. You could have held him. Obviously, they don't have the normal
spring training.
Not
what the Cubs do and just, like, send their guys out for, like, a month for service time, too, before the season starts.
But what I do like about La Russa is that, the last game he did come out and say, that's on me. That was my fault that I kept, or that I didn't put in Liam Hendricks yesterday, because yesterday they blew a game. I think they allowed 7 runs when they were up 4-1, and they ended up losing that one. So I like that he took credibility, but is this something that will continue throughout the season is the question.
Yeah, and that's what I'm afraid of. And so the controversy yesterday was that should they have put Liam Hendricks in the 6th inning when they had bases loaded, and it was a tie game at the time, correct me if I'm wrong. Mm-hmm. But that's the way a lot of teams are using their closer now, is not waiting for the bottom of the ninth, because sometimes the game's won or lost by then, but to get your three most important outs. And there have been studies where they look at how La Russa managed when he was in St. Louis and Oakland, where they thought his style would translate the way he handled the bullpen to the modern game, which was kind of surprising. So he did kind of say that he should have done that, maybe Monday morning quarterbacking it a little bit, but I thought that was interesting that he made a mistake and owned up to it. But it has been interesting some of the ways he hasn't used this bullpen, because that's been... frustrating at times.
I'm just absolutely shocked that Tony La Russa, an ancient he's a Hall of Fame baseball guy,
brother.
But I'm shocked that he was even remotely open to the possibility of changing the way that he manages a game. So that's kind of a bright spot for the future, at least in my opinion, because looking at my own perception coming into the season, I was like, okay. You have this team full of really big personality guys. You've got Jose Abreu, Tim Anderson, Yoan Moncada, who are very good and also very big personalities. Mm-hmm. Yoan Moncada's song, I was just listening to it before we went on, that accompanying music video. If you haven't seen it, go look at it. It's awesome. And then you have Tony La Russa, the oldest, whitest man of all time.
Yeah.
But the fact that Tony is at least a little bit willing to change a little bit, I think is it's optimistic.
And Lucas Giolito said when they were interviewing him on ESPN that, like, when he came in, he said he knew they had a good thing going and didn't want to mess with it too much. So that does give me a little optimism there.
Well, the one thing I wanted to say is, like, we can't overreact about anything, and no team, unless you're bound to be, like, terrible like the Royals, but they're surprising people right now, so they're still doing pretty good. They're at 3-2, but we can't overreact over that either. And for
it's
the Cubs,
nobody knows anything.
No one knows anything. And then for the Cubs, it's kind of, you can a little overreaction, because they are having one of the worst batting averages in MLB history over the past, I think, 60 years it was.
I do want
to... But they won today.
I do want to say that Joe said, before the season started, if all these guys hit like they can, this will be a good team. And
well, I mean,
unfortunately, it doesn't look like the Cubs are.
I mean, it's still way too early to tell. I mean, it is.
And that's the worst thing about talking about baseball a week in is anything you say, you could be like,
Well, it's only one thing, though, about the Cubs.
The Mariners look really bad, but hey, it's only
there is one player that I think it's not too early. It's Craig Kimbrell. He's faced seven batters, and he struck out five of them and put out the. So he hasn't given up a hit yet. So he's looked really well, and like he looked well at the end of last year, and even a little towards in the spring training. But
you have to think about Craig Kimbrell, where he was one of the best closers in baseball for most of his career, and then when
one
he
of
was
the best ever, I don't know.
He struggled
he really
with the Cubs,
was.
But you look at his
not
sample
at the Cubs,
size
though.
With the Cubs, where in 2019 he didn't join them until after the draft when the season was well underway, so he didn't get any preseason, any spring training or anything like that. Then last season they had spring training, they went on hold, then they picked up again, so it was a weird off season, not a regular year. This is his first normal year since the 2018 season, first normal year with the Cubs with the preseason training and then spring training games. So I think now we're seeing him kind of return to form, what he's more capable of. So that could be very, very dangerous for teams in the NL Central if Craig Kimbrell is back.
And that's really exciting for you Northsiders who have had a little bit of...
Our pitching's been good, like this as of right now.
This year, and what a weird shift from last year, where the bullpen was like one of the major issues of the entire team. And so to have Craig Kimbrell kind of manning the back of that, it's promising for the Cubs, especially in an NL Central that is really up for grabs right now.
Yeah,
between the Cubs, Cardinals, and Brewers, I wouldn't even put money on who I thought was going to win because I have no confidence that any of these teams are going to be able to pull away. It just depends on how they are able to stay healthy and improve over the course of 162 games.
And it's going to be interesting to see if they're going to want to trade Kimbrell at the end of at the deadline, and maybe some other players too
Is he on the last year of his contract?
I believe so, yeah.
Oh, wow.
And it's like a lot of people on the last year of their contract. But even because... they want to rebuild. Like, it's like they haven't even really said like what they really want to do at the moment, and it's really frustrating because you're not quite sure as a fan.
So if you're in the front office of the Cubs and you get to a point where you're battling for first in the NL Central right now, you have all these guys whose contracts expire at the end of the year, are you going to be buying in one last ditch effort to try to win another a championship before all these guys go their separate ways, because you're not going to have the money to sign them all? Well, or are you trying to get something for those guys before they walk out the door?
It all depends on how they're doing, because 2017, 2018, 2019, and 2020, it seems like it's all been kind of the same thing, where it's like only a couple guys are able to step on offense, or even everyone. Like this year, the Cubs just haven't looked good on the offensive side of the ball at all. Their leading batter right now is Jake Marisnyk, and then after that it's Chris Bryant, who's still doing a couple. He has now two home runs on the season. He had one today. Javier Baez had another home run, but it's just frustrating to see because at the deadline, who knows? It depends what their record's going to be at, and even if they're doing well, I could still see him.
So let's say they have a two-game lead in the NL Central for number one. What are you doing? At the trade deadline. Are you buying or selling?
We're two games back?
Two games up.
Okay, if we're two games up, I mean, you're definitely going to have to sell one person away because you're not going to keep everyone back, and the front office and the players probably know that. So there's definitely going to be at least one guy gone either. I think it's going to be Contreras for sure. Baez, I feel like, is most likely to stay, and then maybe Rizzo, but... same with KB. It's really hard to feel out right now.
And it just all depends on how the Cubs do, but it's nice to know that Southside's got the better team in baseball in the Chicago right
we'll
now.
We'll see about that. It's only a week. but we'd like to thank you for listening to this week's edition of the Red Zone. We'd like to thank Steve Holm, Brendan McNerney for joining us on the show. If you missed any part of tonight's show, you could go to WZND.com and listen. We're going to have the podcast up in just a few minutes. You've been listening to the Red Zone on WZND. I'm Leo Stauderher. For Joey Dwyer, Joe Kennedy, thank you for listening. We'll be back next week with plenty more coverage from high school to the pros.
To hear this and other past episodes of The Red Zone again, download the Red Zone podcast online at WZND.com or on iTunes. And of course, tune into The Red Zone every Thursday at 6, right here on 1033 WZND.
The Pulse of Redbird Nation.